Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after.
Well, it's great to be back amongst you after Easter. Do keep that passage open in front of you on the sheet, and you can see opposite it on the notice sheet a kind of outline for where we're going that you might want to scribble notes on or questions for your discussion afterwards. On Monday evening, we settled down as a family to do something we don't often have an opportunity to do, and that was to watch a movie together. It was the bank holiday movie on BBC One. If you like the kind of rip-roaring, treasure hunt kind of movie starring Nicolas Cage, it was of that ilk, and it was great fun. I enjoyed it most, I think, because central to the plot is the glorious city of Philadelphia and its most famous citizen, Benjamin Franklin, the scientist and the inventor, the statesman, and one of the founding fathers of the United States. My kids weren't too interested in my anecdotes about Benjamin Franklin, so let's see if you will be more tolerant. Back in 2006, Philadelphia's main orchestra commissioned a piece of music to mark the 300th anniversary of his birth. And at the concert, at the gala concert where this was announced, the composer stood forward and asked members of the audience to suggest words that would sum up a piece of music most appropriate to the great old man. One member of the audience suggested the word revolutionary, thinking no doubt of Franklin's role in securing American independence from her English overlords. Another member of the audience suggested the word electric, thinking no doubt of that famous experiment with the kite and the key and the bolt of lightning. But the man who drew the biggest laugh on the evening told the composer that whatever else he did, he had to ensure that his piece of music was profitable. Because what could be more in keeping with a man whose maxims include nothing but money is sweeter than honey, and early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy and wise. Well, after that reading, listening to that reading in Ecclesiastes, you might well conclude that the writer of this book shared the same profit motive as the business savvy Benjamin Franklin. Because look down to verse 3, would you? What does he say? What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? It's the writer's big question of life. And the writer of Ecclesiastes is either King Solomon himself or else someone who's writing many, many years later, who wants us to think of the tragic downfall of Solomon as a cautionary tale for God's people, Israel, at the time of her exile in Babylon, and for you and me today. He obviously had some role in the assembly of God's people. So verse 1, the preacher. The word gain there in verse 3, that's from the world of business. That's from your offices. It refers to the surplus. It refers to the profit. It refers to all that is left after the expenses have been paid. Did you get the question? The preacher is willing to work hard, but he wants to know the bottom line. He wants to know the cash value. He wants to know what's the point. It's a key question to which he returns again and again in the book. And it's one of those do your sums and work out the answers kind of question. Am I really accomplishing anything, he asks. At the end of the week, at the end of the month, at the end of the year, as I look back, what have I got to show for all my toil? But please notice, it's also an honest question. Mr. Preacher, he asks the question that most people ask of any job. Is it worth it? He asks the kind of question that you might ask as you stand waiting on the platform yet again for the train that's held up. Or as you're stuck in the traffic jam on the motorway. What's the point? Where's the profit? Or as we switch on the TV news and watch the bloodshed from Benghazi or the suffering in Sendai. What's the point? It is an honest question, isn't it? And nor is it, as some have argued, merely a question for the atheist. As if somehow Christians, you're immune from having to ask the tough questions of life. Do you see? You might be young, and your prospects may be good, but there will be people here today who have been victims of crime, others who've been unemployed. I'm struggling with this microphone. Others who've been unemployed or struggled with depression, others who are suffering from health concerns or have lost loved ones. You can see why it would be the kind of question that... There was no light on at all, Ruth. Is that significant? The battery's run out. Okay, I'll go without it, I think. Don't worry. You'll battle over the air conditioning, I hope. Where were we? There'll be people in a crowd like this who have been victims of crime. There'll be some who have suffered unemployment or struggled with depression. Some who suffer from health concerns. And others who've lost loved ones. You can see why it would be a question that Israel would ask in exile, in Babylon. They're meant to be God's people. They're meant to be enjoying God's blessing in God's promised land. And yet there they are in Babylon, experiencing God's judgment and curse rather than enjoying his blessing. What's the point? Well, that question takes us to the preacher's humbling conclusion. And that's our first point for today. A humbling conclusion, that's life. You see, the question in verse 3 is rhetorical. It doesn't need an answer because for Mr. Preacher, the answer is as obvious as it is awful. Look down to verse 2, would you? Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Do you see, Ecclesiastes as a book has an openness that we find refreshing, I take it. Mr. Preacher won't hide from reality. When we see the sum total of everything, he says, it just seems as if it's all in vain, as if it's futile, as if it's pointless. The word he uses here for vanity is a Hebrew word, hevel, that means breath or vapour. As I left the house this morning, it was very cold. I breathed out as I walked down the street, and I could see my breath, but then it disappeared. He's saying that's what life is like. It's like a bubble when your kid's playing with one of those things, and they blow a bubble, and you try and grab it, but pop, it's gone. Life is elusive. You can't get hold of it. Just when you think you've fathomed it out, just when you think you can see some rhyme or reason to life, something else happens to deny it. We don't get to choose the script, and many people wrestle with it. Frank Sinatra famously sang about it, didn't he? That's life, that's what people say. You're riding high in April, but shot down in May. But I know I'm going to change that tune when I'm back on top in June. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. that's life. You see, he's saying, that's what life is like. And the writer is saying, that's what life is like. Life under the sun, genetics. It's another phrase that comes again and again in the book. The writer, the preacher, is talking about his observations about life. Life in this world. This world of time and space. He knows there's another world. He knows about eternity. He talks about it only a couple of chapters into the book. And yet he can't see it. And as he looks at the world as it really is, notice he refuses to run from reality. And he won't allow you and me to run from reality either. Do you see, if his honesty is refreshing, it's also slightly unsettling. Especially if we're the kind of person who's tempted to flee to fantasy islands. Now, he wants us to stop running from reality. And instead, he wants us to wake up and to face it. That's life, says Mr. Preacher. And as if to prove his point, he draws on observations both from the natural world and also from human experience. Why is it that life seems so elusive? Notice three reasons he gives. First, nothing changes, he says. Look down to verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. As we talk about the next generation, we often speak, don't we, as if it's, there are great hope for tomorrow, for the future. As if they're evidence of progress, and yet generation X, Y and Z come and go, but nothing really changes. There's a seemingly endless procession of people heading to the cemetery and being born in the maternity ward. But the world remains the same forever. Things may appear to change, but in reality, nothing changes. Everything stays the same. We're just like the rest of nature. Take the sun, verse 5. Like us, it rises every morning. It drags itself through the day, literally panting wearily to reach its destination before it pops down its head and goes to bed every evening before repeating the process the following day. Life is like a carousel, Mr. Preacher is saying. It moves fast, it's momentarily exciting, but it goes nowhere. Or take the wind, verse 6, restlessly blowing from north or south. Lots of frenetic activity, but just like your busy life and my busy life, what's it doing? What's it achieving? It never gets to where it's going. Nothing changes, everything stays the same. Then think of the rivers and the streams, verse 7. You can almost hear someone interrupting at this point, can't you, and saying, hang on, Mr. Preacher, I can see that the sun and the wind might appear not to get anywhere, but what about those rivers marching relentlessly towards their destination, rushing to fill the sea? And yet someone's forgot to put the plug in. And so the oceans are never full, are they? There's constant activity, and yet change is elusive. And the writer is saying life is like that. It often feels as if it's stuck in a rut. Where's the progress? Where's the profit? Nothing changes. Everything stays the same. It sounds so depressing, and yet it is hard to argue with him, isn't it? So what makes us think we can do something that's significant? What makes us think we can buck the trend by our own human exertions? Verse 3, what can we gain? Our human efforts can't change the course of events any more than the sun can. We can run this way and that way and the other way, like the wind and like the water, but we never get anywhere. We just run. But what are we doing? What are we achieving? Life is elusive. And to ensure that we don't miss the point, did you notice how he moves from exploring these natural phenomena to examining human experience? So verse 8, what does he say? All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. You see, nothing changes and nothing satisfies. Just like the oceans, our senses are being bombarded every day by a barrage of images, by an endless stream of sounds. And yet Mr. Preacher says, for all your text messaging and Facebooking and Twittering and Flickering, we are lost for words. We're worn out trying to fathom our frustrating world. One translation puts verse 8 in this way: all of life is far more boring than words can ever say. Brutal, isn't it? But it's true. What have we gained? What have we accomplished? Do you remember Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon? One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Well, 11 years later, someone else wrote this. He said, you can walk on the moon if you like, but there's nothing to do when you're there except look at the Earth. And once you've seen one Earth, you've seen them all. It's sobering. He might have read Ecclesiastes. It's a humbling conclusion. Nothing changes. Nothing satisfies. So verse 9, what has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Think of newspapers. Let's rename them. Let's call them old papers, because there's nothing ever that's new in them. It's just the names that are different. There are still wars. There are always wars, just different countries. There's still turmoil and revolution. There's always turmoil, just different leaders. Still scandals, always scandals, just different footballers and politicians. Someone protests, verse 10. Surely this is new, they say. But Mr. Preacher says, no, 'twas ever thus. Nothing changes. I think this is our difficulty. I think our difficulty is that because technology changes, we assume there is a parallel progress in human history. But think about it. We deal with the bubonic plague and TB and influenza only for cancer and heart disease to be the big killers. And if we ever manage to deal with them totally, well, what about Ebola or AIDS, which of course brings TB in its wake all over again? But we recoil from the horror of the Holocaust, of Auschwitz and Belsen, only to stumble into the killing fields of Cambodia, of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, only to reel into the genocide of Rwanda and the Sudan. We imprison Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, only to discover Fred and Rosemary West. We recover from the senseless IRA bombs of the 70s and 80s, only to usher in Al-Qaeda, 9/11 and the War on Terror. Do you see, the list goes on and on and on. And as if to rouse us, to wake us up from our historical amnesia, Mr. Preacher gives it to us straight, with both barrels. Nothing changes, he says. Nothing satisfies. And notice, nothing lasts, verse 11. There is no remembrance, he says, of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. You ever have that experience of walking into one of those great boardrooms of the city, where the kind of the imposing portraits of the founding fathers of the firm hang? Impressive men in their day, perhaps, but who remembers them now? They're just names. Some of you will remember Tony Hancock, but I guess others of you will never have heard of him. Kind of makes the point, because in his day he was the most famous comedian of all. He was the Michael McIntyre, if you like, of his generation. Here's his final TV monologue that he shot a few days before he committed suicide. Here's what he said. What have you achieved? What have you achieved? You lost your chance, my old son. You've contributed absolutely nothing to life. A waste of time, you being here at all. No place for you at Westminster Abbey. The best you can hope for is a few daffodils in a jam jar. A rough-hewn stone bearing the legend, he came and he went. And in between, nothing. Nobody will notice you're not here. After a year or so, someone might say down the pub, where's old Hancock? Haven't seen him around lately. Oh, he's dead, you know. Is he? A right raison d'etre, that is. Nobody else will ever even know that I exist. Nothing to leave behind, nothing to pass on, nobody to mourn me. That's the bitterest blow of all. It is brutal, isn't it? But it's true, because very few people go down in history. Most of us, we end up as names in a crematorium or on a tombstone. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well, friends, we've had the honest question. What's the point? And we've had the preacher's humbling conclusion. That's life. But we can't stop there because there's more to life than that. And the great news is there's more to Ecclesiastes too. So as we conclude for today, notice our hopeful challenge. The world is not enough. You see, Mr. Preacher, he wants us to see the world the way that God sees it and to think what God is thinking. So three brief applications as we conclude. First application, get real. Get real because this is our world and we cannot escape it. And yet there are so many ways today in which people try to run away from reality, aren't there? We shut ourselves off in the garden or the greenhouse. We tune out with the headphones on, listening to our favourite tracks or tunes. We zone out with alcohol or drugs. But do you hear what the preacher is saying? He's saying, you cannot run from reality. Ladies, sorry if this is a gender caricature, you cannot shop till you drop with retail therapy. Blokes, you can't drink till you can't stand. We can't lose ourselves in the soap opera or the rom-com. We can't fantasise as we watch sport, hoping and praying that it's us who scores the winning goal to knock out United rather than the Germans or the Spanish. We cannot escape our world. So let's stop the escapist thinking. I don't know how you escape. Here's a selection. If only I'd gone to a different school. If only I'd gone to a different university. If only I had a better job. If only I had a husband or a wife or a better husband or a better wife. If only we could afford a bigger house, a better car. If only, if only, if only, then life would be better. Now, do you see what Mr. Preacher is saying? He says, keep your feet on the ground. This is our world and we cannot escape. We need to remember those foundational lessons from the very beginning of the Bible, from Genesis 1 and 2. This is God's world. He made it. So Mr. Preacher says, remember we're creatures. We can't explain why the world is like this, and we cannot make sense of life. That's why, secondly, we need to get revelation. Because as creatures, we desperately need God's word on God's world. Otherwise, it will forever be frustrating for us. Have a look at verse 3 again. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? The world that Mr. Preacher is describing is a world under the sun. It is our world. It is the created universe. But that is not all there is. He's not an atheist. He's not even a skeptic. He believes in the God of Israel. He believes that there is a heavenly perspective as well as an earthly one. But to get that perspective, well, we need God to reveal it to us. We need the Creator God to break into our frustrating world with a final word. A word that will give us the meaning of life, the key to life. And the rest of the Bible says that is just what God has done in the person of his Son, Jesus Christ. That first Christmas, God broke into time and space and he made himself known to us. He made known what he's like, what this world is about, and how and why we should live. Do you see, we need to get real, we need to get revelation, and then finally, we need to get ready. Because it is only when this world is spoiled for us, that when we are disillusioned with life under the sun, that Mr. Preacher thinks we'll stop expecting to find meaning and significance in earthly things, and only then will we look instead to God himself. And only when we look at this natural world and all the natural phenomena through God's divine lens can we see God's goodness, can we see God's orderliness rather than the frustration and the futility. Only then can we say with the psalmist, the heavens declare the glory of God. Only then can we see the sun, not as an example of tedious repetition, but as the strong man who runs his course through the day. Only then can we say with Jeremiah, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And only when we examine our own human experience through the lens that is Christ-centered will we see the new thing that God is doing in Jesus Christ. The new covenant in his blood. The new life which Jesus gives. The new heart in which Jesus' spirit lives. The new self that God starts to grow in his people. The new creation that begins with every new Christian and finds its fulfillment in the new heavens and the new earth. Only in the light of all that God is making new can God's people ever have hope for the future, and can God's people have encouragement to persevere when this world feels most frustrating. That's Ecclesiastes 1 to 11. It's over to you, I think, now for discussion, if you'd like to, round your tables. And there's a couple of questions at the bottom of the sheet for you to discuss. And if you've got questions, I think there's a question time at the end of the series. Is that? I'm looking to Ruth. Ruth's nodding. Scribble down your questions and give them to Ruth before you leave, so that for the question time at the end of the series. Let me pray and thank you for listening. Our gracious God, we thank and praise you for all the frustrations of living in this world, of microphones that don't work, of air conditioning that's too noisy, of work and jobs that are stressful, of daily lives that are full of little frustrations to remind us that this world is not all that it should be. Help us instead, we pray, to lift our eyes and to look to you. And please would you teach us over these next few weeks and give us your insight and your wisdom on your world. For we ask it for Jesus' sake. Amen.